From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America has the world's largest economy, but on the dark side of that trillion-dollar marvel is an underground economy that is absolutely booming on pornography, marijuana, and illegal migrant labor. In his last book, best-selling author Eric Schlosser took us to the grease pits in Fast Food Nation. Now he takes us to the economic badlands in his new book, Reefer Madness. Tonight on Point, sex, drugs, and cheap labor in the American black market. We begin in Ottawa, Canada, where the Canadian government is moving to relax its marijuana laws with plans to decriminalize possession of less than 30 grams of the drug. I spoke earlier with Janice Tibbetts, national affairs reporter for CanWest News Service. She's covering developments in the Canadian Parliament and Supreme Court. I asked her how close Canada is to decriminalizing pot.
Well, I would say that legislation is very close. It's expected within the next 6 weeks or before our Canadian Parliament recesses for its summer session in mid-June.
And exactly what is the change in law?
Right now, it is considered a criminal offense to be caught with any amount of marijuana. It means that you would have a criminal record. The change in law that they're proposing is that if you're caught with 30 grams or less, which is the equivalent of, they say, about 25 or 30 cigarettes, you would still get some sort of a penalty. They're not saying that it's going to be legalized, but what would be is you would get a fine probably, something like a parking ticket, and you wouldn't be punished with a criminal record.
What is the Canadian government's reasoning for relaxing its marijuana laws?
Well, they say that things haven't been working as effectively as they should, that police in some provinces have been turning a blind eye to marijuana possession for quite some time because they know that it does carry a criminal record. They're saying with this, it'll be more efficient in that police will be more likely to enforce the law, is what they say, knowing that the punishment won't be as severe.
So is the message from the Canadian government that marijuana smoking is not such a big deal, or that it's not a good thing, but we're simply not going to punish it in the same way?
I think what they are saying is that they are still going to crack down on trafficking. They want to put the resources, they say, into trafficking, and they want to, I guess, free up the police, this is their argument, to pursue that and not go after the small-time users.
We read that the scale of illegal marijuana cultivation in Canada has been skyrocketing. Can you give us some sense of that?
Yes, that's right. Marijuana cultivation, especially in some provinces, has become very, very big business. Marijuana grow houses are springing up everywhere in residential neighborhoods. Houses that people buy just for the purpose of growing, cultivating marijuana, they are massive operations.
I read that it's increased sixfold since 1993. That's very big growth.
Indeed, there's now a national task force that's pursuing this exclusively.
What's the center? Is it in British Columbia or where else?
It is believed that the center of it is in British Columbia, yeah. It pretty well started in Vancouver. It's made its way across Western Canada into Central Canada, and it's, they say, even heading out to Maritime Canada as well.
What's the Canadian public's response to these proposed relaxed penalties for marijuana use been?
50-50 split is what public opinion is saying. In fact, there was a case in our Supreme Court of Canada today. There was a hearing where three people were arguing for the legalization of marijuana. They say that this has been promised for a long time. There have been royal commissions that have recommended it. Last summer, there was a Senate committee that recommended complete legalization. They were arguing in our Supreme Court today for the constitutional right to smoke marijuana.
But the government's saying we're not legalizing, we're just decriminalizing. With a 50-50 split in the polls, why politically is Canada's government pushing ahead with this so vigorously?
That is a very good question that they have never answered very, very clearly. It started last summer when Britain did a very similar thing. We have a justice minister here who's pretty young, pretty liberal. He's from probably arguably Canada's most liberal province, Quebec, and I think he wants to do something and he sees this as an issue.
If the Parliament goes ahead and approves this legislation, when would the new laws come into effect? When would it just be a kind of a parking ticket for smoking pot in Canada?
They haven't said when it would come into effect. It has to go through the whole legislative process. It could take literally years before it happens.
And we know that Washington has not taken kindly to this whole movement in Canada. What kind of response has the Canadian government heard from U.S. officials on this move?
Yes, they certainly haven't. The U.S. ambassador here in Ottawa has said that you're looking at holdups at the border. people are going to be checked more. Obviously, the U.S. is very serious about their war on drugs, and they say that anything that harms that in any way is going to also hamper Canada-U.S. relations, which are already a little bit on the shaky side right now because of Canada's failure to support the war in Iraq.
You've quoted Tom Riley, the Public Affairs Director for the White House Office of Drug Control Policy, calling Canada's failure to consult Washington on this change in drug policy comparable to setting up an open-air toxic waste site along the border. That's pretty hot language.
We've heard some other things, too. We've also heard from the Director of the White House Drug Control Policy, I believe it is, who said that Canada is returning to the Cheech and Chong years, and this is reefer madness. And no one said we're telling you what to do with your law, but they're saying talk to us at least, because we have this big border here between us, and we want to keep it secure, and this could be a potential, really a big problem.
And the threat from Washington is, as I understand it, that they would demand to know, ultimately, which Canadians had been served with one of these marijuana parking ticket-style fines, and they might delay their admission to the United States at the border, if and when those Canadians were traveling south.
That's right. We've heard that as a potential fallout as well. That could happen.
How's the Canadian government responding to the pressure from Washington?
Publicly, they say, yes, we're talking to the Americans, but it doesn't seem like it's happened at very high levels. And another thing they're saying is, we can do what we want. This is Canada, and we can have our own drug policy. But at the same time, I think what they're trying to say is we will be cracking down on the most serious users, so that trafficking is still going to be a very, very serious offense, and that will be pursued.
And Janice, what have you heard from Canada's immigration authorities and maybe even the business community? If and when this goes through, do they expect to see much more traffic from Americans traveling north to Canada for a Purple Haze holiday?
That's a distinct possibility.
Do they welcome that?
I would say that they would not welcome that.
Janice Tibbetts, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Janice Tibbetts is National Affairs Reporter for CanWest News Service. She spoke with us earlier from Ottawa. Everything is big in America, including the black market. We don't speak of it, but it's there, a strange brew of ingenuity, greed, idealism, and hypocrisy, says our guest tonight, that churns at the heart of American culture. The underground U.S. economy may account for as much as 20% of the nation's economy, hundreds of billions of dollars moving through the dark arteries of a shadow business world, and it's growing. In his new book, Reefer Madness, our guest tonight, Fast Food Nation author Eric Schlosser, lifts the lid on the three great black market sectors, pornography, marijuana, and illegal labor. America's faith in the free market, he says, combined with a powerful Puritanism, has built an underground economic continent where porn peddlers are mighty businessmen, small-time pot smokers serve life sentences, and the nation's food is served up on the backs of undocumented workers. It all adds up, he says, to a deep inconsistency between America's public and private morality. So is this shocking to you, or just a part of everyday life? How much of your life intersects with the black market? Do you know? Do you care? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Eric Schlosser. His new book is Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. He's also author of Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal. Good evening and welcome, Eric Schlosser.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us in the studio tonight is our friend, the distinguished Randall Kennedy, tonight's on-point news analyst and professor of law at Harvard University. Randall Kennedy, great to have you back.
Thanks so much.
Great to have you here. Eric Schlosser, we know we're going to hear tonight about pot and pornography and illegal labor, but of all things, your book starts out with a reference to Adam Smith and the hand of the divine, the hand of God. Draw the line for us between Adam Smith and all that lies beneath the glossy surface of the American economy.
Well, for the last 20 years, we've been dominated in this country by a free market ideology, which looks at the workings of the market much as Adam Smith did, as the workings of the divine, the invisible hand matching up buyers and sellers and creating a social ideal. And in this book, I try to explore those businesses and those markets that haven't been celebrated, haven't been discussed in the same way, but it's my argument are as much a part of this country as our telecommunications industry or our software industry. The line between the underground and the mainstream isn't always fixed, and I think they're ultimately part of the same thing. You were mentioning the underground earlier. One of the most significant things isn't just the size of it in the United States, but how much it's been growing over the last 20 to 30 years and growing throughout the Western world.
Give us a sense both of its size and its dynamic growth.
Well, because, you know, these are unreported economic activities, illegal, no one knows exactly what their size, what the size is, but I rely on estimates by a conservative Austrian economist working for the International Monetary Fund, who's looked at our underground economy and those of the EU and other developing nations. And many economists believe that the black market has roughly doubled in size since around 1970 in the United States and is now conservatively 8 to 10, maybe 12% of our gross domestic product.
Of the world's biggest economy.
So that would work out to, you know, easily $1 trillion in economic activity that's off the books.
So how do you define the underground economy? Where do you draw the line? What's underground and what's not? And I guess, more than that, why this spurt in growth in the last couple, 3 decades?
Well, you know, the underground, broadly defined, are all those transactions that are unrecorded, unreported, and somehow in violation of the law. That may be a criminal activity, like the manufacturing of methamphetamine, or it may be a seemingly innocuous activity, paying your contractor in cash, well aware that the payment will never be recorded as income. Cash is at the heart of this black market economy, and as I write in the book, the $100 bill has become the currency of choice not only in our black market, but worldwide.
And why the explosion?
The explosion has to do with many forces. I mean, the people on the right would argue that when tax rates get too high, people start evading taxes and going into the black market. That would be like the contractor accepting cash. The left would argue that once businesses don't face the same sort of regulations, they're more apt to use black market labor, import illegal immigrants. There's also been an explosion in the drug economy and the rise. I write about marijuana, which is the most widely used illegal drug. When people are feeling alienated, when people feel that the laws don't represent what they want to do or don't allow them to do what they do, they do it on their own. You saw in the Soviet Union a gigantic, gigantic black market, and that's because the state wasn't providing the services that people wanted.
We're going to come and look at these, the three big pillars that you look at, porn, pot, illegal labor. But at the end of it all, what does it matter, Eric Schlosser, if there's an enormous exploding black market? So what?
I think it matters enormously in an industrialized country like ours. You find the biggest black markets in transitional and developing nations. In Nigeria, for example, 76% of the economy is said to be in the underground. Nigeria is also said to have the highest level of corruption. So you want the laws to reflect what people want. And if you pay taxes, you're paying taxes for all the people who aren't paying taxes in the underground.
So you're describing this kind of a nation out of touch with itself if so much of its economy is off the books.
Absolutely. And it has a huge consequence if you're involved in one of these activities that the law doesn't like. And I write in the book about, you know, relatively minor marijuana crimes that can result in very, very long prison sentences.
Randall Kennedy, there's a lot of stunning detail in here, and we're going to get into it after a break. But top line, here it is, a whole bunch of the economy that's out of sight and often out of mind, at least outside the mainstream conversation of our country. What does it matter in your mind?
Well, it's a rich subject that can go in lots of different directions, but for me, the most compelling aspect of this is the crisis of overregulation, particularly over-criminalization. I mean, we heard about Canada rethinking its drug laws. You can't even debate that in the United States.
You run out of town on a rail.
Well, presidential candidates may disagree about a lot of things, but when it comes to drugs, nope, there's consensus, and it's a stultifying consensus. Also, with respect to some of the other underground activities, I think especially of pornography, we have the specter of the government really encroaching upon civil liberties. So I think that one important aspect of this is just over-regulation.
We're going to come back and dig into regulation, over-regulation, pot, porn, illegal labor. We're looking tonight at Black Market America with Eric Schlosser. He's author of the new book, Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. You can join the conversation. Is this shocking to you or everyday life? How much of your life is lived in the black market? A little? A lot? All of it? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about black market America, the pot, porn, and illegal labor economy, the implications of the off-the-books economy, with muckraking author Eric Schlosser. He's author of Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. Randall Kennedy is with us as well as our news analyst tonight from Harvard Business School. You can join the conversation. Is this an outrage or just pluralistic America on display? Why do we look past the black market? And is America regulated too much or too little? Are we over-regulated or too libertine? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Eric Schlosser, I wish you'd give us a quick thumbnail of each of these great big sectors that you write about. Each one is so enormous. But just in terms of scale and dynamism, pornography, pot, illegal labor, line these out for us.
Well, each one is there for a reason to try to explain the workings of the black market. I write about marijuana as a black market commodity. It's a drug that isn't being imported by the Colombian cartel. It's one that's being grown in the heartland of America, multi-billion-dollar business. Some people may think it may be our largest cash crop. So in looking at marijuana, it's a black market commodity.
Move over corn and soybeans. You've got a contender here.
Absolutely. The next one is illegal immigrants, and particularly the exploitation of migrant workers in California. This is black market labor with huge implications for workers in other industry as illegals are imported.
And talk about turning a blind eye. I mean, everybody knows about this, but it's just an invisible subject.
And Professor Kennedy made an interesting point. I mean, this government is very interested in over-regulating people's personal lives. But when it comes to the exploitation of the poorest people in our society, suddenly the free market prevails. There's no need for government regulation. There's a lot of talk in Congress now about making the minimum wage voluntary.
And as you say in the book, interestingly, as people try to move away from industrialized farming, they actually move into more labor-intensive farming. So the kind of granola and organic broccoli crowd may be among the biggest beneficiaries of that illegal labor?
Well, if you're eating a very healthy diet full of fresh fruits and fresh vegetables, you are connected to this exploitation of migrant workers. And, I mean, it's remarkable that this type of work, which is, you know, thousands of years of history, it's manual labor, is actually growing in the United States. And the number of migrants has been expanding because you need hands to pick every one of those strawberries and those grapes.
And then there's the one that I guess I knew least about as an industry. You call it the empire of the obscene,
yeah.
Pornography. And my first question there is, I mean, not all pornography is illegal. Where is the line between above and below an underground pornography?
Well, one of the themes of the book is how the distinctions between the underground and the mainstream are often very arbitrary. And in the pornography section, which is the concluding section of the book, I look at how a deviant black market commodity like pornography, which in the 50s could get you a prison sentence, how that becomes a mainstream commodity. Now a corporate commodity, so that the same sort of thing that, you know, fringe elements and organized crime figures were being sent to prison for 30 years ago, very big American corporations are now selling quite profitably, the big cable companies, satellite companies. And again, it's an example of how the deviant becomes mainstream.
But a lot of it's not black market. If it's right there on your cable television every night, that's what I guess we would consider part of the entertainment, the legal entertainment economy.
Absolutely. And that section is told through the story of really the great robber baron of the porn industry.
The kingpin of it all. Tell us about him in that story. It's a great
name,
one.
His name was Reuben Sturman, and he started out as a small-time Cleveland businessman. I'd never heard of him, and yet his porn empire eventually was much bigger than that of Hugh Hefner's or Larry Flint's.
How did it get started? How did he build it?
He started out selling comic books to little mom-and-pop stores in Cleveland, and began to distribute a few girly magazines, which by today's standard would be incredibly tame, and yet the government tried to prosecute him for obscenity charges, and his empire got bigger and bigger until he controlled the production and distribution of hardcore pornography, not just in the United States, but throughout the world. And through his career, you see how the black market becomes mainstream, and his successors really are companies like AOL, Time Warner, and Marriott, and companies.
Now, why do you say that? I'm sure that the PR people from those companies would be standing on their chair right now. How, in what sense, are they successors
of the originator
of porn?
They are how many, many middle Americans are now watching hardcore pornography and pornography through these pay-per-view cable and satellite systems, through hotel room pornography, the sort of material that HBO shows on a typical night. Is much more sexually explicit than what you could show in America in the late 1950s and 1960s, and people were prosecuted and imprisoned for it.
So there's the mainstream economy kind of plugging in on the labor front and certainly on the pornography front to the underground economy right beneath it.
That's right, and I don't think we're going to see the same sort of obscenity prosecutions now, because there are big companies that are earning millions of dollars from it, as opposed to individuals who are much easier to go after.
Randall Kennedy, this sounds like economic codependency. I mean, it's kind of a round and round you go circle here, above and below ground.
Well, in a way it is, and the economics are a very interesting and compelling part of Reefer Madness. For me, some of the legal aspects naturally would be of tremendous interest, and in your chapter about Reuben Sturman, the thing that I found most chilling was the way in which the government of the United States went after various disseminators of pornography and simply tried to put them out of business through the use of criminal prosecutions.
Yeah.
Could you speak to that?
Well, you know, the thing about obscenity as a crime that's different from most other criminal acts is a murder, a rape, an armed robbery is a very clear-cut event. An obscenity crime occurs in the mind. Obscenity is something that has to be determined by a jury. And as the government increasingly found it difficult to convict people on obscenity charges for pornography, because most jurors say, well, this is adult material that adults should have access to, during the Bush administration, they pursued strategies of prosecuting you in many, many districts simultaneously, not expecting to win a conviction in any one venue, but realizing that if you had to fight 9, 10, 15 cases at once, you'd rather cop a plea and go out of business rather than have to, you know, spend millions of dollars to defend yourself.
Mm. Let me ask you, you know, when people use the term porn, P-O-R-N, it's usually said with a sort of a dripping derision. What's your own view of porn? Do you look down on this particular commodity?
You know, some of it's really terrible. I'm not prudish. I think that, you know, sexual expression should be constitutionally protected. Most of the mainstream porn artistically is like wrestling. I mean, it's just this caricature of the sexual act, and a lot of it is very misogynistic. But I believe very strongly that what consenting adults want behind closed doors, as long as children aren't being hurt or there's no violence involved, is not the government's business at all. And that it's interesting, again, that the government is willing to intervene so fiercely in people's private lives, but not intervene on behalf of other people who are being so badly exploited economically.
We want to talk about that and the origins of that. We're looking at Black Market America tonight with Eric Schlosser, author of Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. You can join the conversation. Does the black market damage the U.S. economy or just round it out? And what most fuels this black market? American Puritanism, hypocrisy, law? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What about it, Eric Schlosser? You draw these lines between Puritanism and the scale of the black market in the United States. You're saying things are put out of bounds and grow out of bounds to enormous proportion, even when the kind of Puritan ethic that would have put them out of bounds is no longer the operative or dominant ethic?
It's still a very powerful ethic in this country. I mean, our Attorney General, upon taking office, covered up the bare breasts of the Statue of Justice.
Right in the lobby there in Washington.
And maybe, you know, when he saw that, she had the blindfold on. He wasn't quite sure what was going on there. Sure. But, you know, our country was literally founded by Puritans, but also by nonbelievers, nonconformists, dissenters, and we have that deeply in our culture, a Puritan instinct and a very rebellious instinct. If you look at the beliefs of our founding fathers, these were incredible iconoclasts in the context of their day. And those trends are constantly at war in our culture. We swing back and forth. And right now, I think there's a huge gulf between the powers that be and how ordinary people are living their lives in the United States. And that fuels the black market. You know, one example of why is the black market a bad thing? Well, in Los Angeles County, this is an incredible statistic. In Los Angeles County right now, about 28% of all wages are being paid in cash. And that's a very, very disturbing thing. That's a reversion to outdated modes of economic activity, and it's very disturbing for this country.
And what about the impact on revenue collection for the government? Of course, at the federal, state, local levels, everyone is starving these days. How much of this economic activity is just getting off scot-free, not contributing to the common weal?
Well, in 1998, when the IRS did a study of how much federal tax was going unpaid, this is 5 years ago, they estimated that about $200 billion in taxes was going uncollected, and that represents about $1.5 trillion in unreported income, and that doesn't include criminal activity. Now, $200 billion is more than enough to cover our Medicare. So ideally, you know, I believe in few laws strictly enforced, and you want people to be paying their taxes and for the government to be able to operate. And again, everyone who does pay their taxes is covering the government services for everyone who doesn't.
Listeners, why do we look past this enormous black market? We're at 1-800-423-8255 with Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation and now Reefer Madness. George is calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, George. You're on the air.
Hi. Just a little background. I own a small business. My wife is a school teacher, and one thing is we can't understand why they don't legalize marijuana. And I'll be honest, I look at porn. I pay the guy that works for me cash sometimes, and I do a lot of cash jobs where people just pay me cash. And we don't really understand why the government don't legalize it. And I smoke it once in a great while. And why don't they legalize it? There's so much money to be made by the government.
Well, George, thanks for your call. Eric Schlosser, of course, here it is, the great should we legalize drugs debate. We heard Canada struggling with that right now. Of course, you've got some rather conservative figures, an economist in the United States who said we should. It would take it out of the criminal hands. It will bring in revenue, control it, make it a more kind of rational business than it is right now. Here's the simple question from La Crosse. Why not?
Well, you know, the title of the book is Reefer Madness, and the title of that section is Reefer Madness, and it's because our policy towards marijuana from the beginning has been driven by unreason and has been based much more not on the properties of this drug but on the people who smoke it. The war on marijuana, in my view, has traditionally been a war on nonconformists and on minorities. The people who smoked pot in the early days of the 20th century were poor Mexicans and African Americans. There was no trouble. The government had no trouble imprisoning these people. And if you look at the various bohemians, you know, from jazz musicians to beatniks to hippies and now the hip-hop community, marijuana is the intoxicant and has been the intoxicant for minorities and for nonconformists. And if you look at the actual physical properties of the drug, you know, it's less harmful than alcohol. I mean, I'm not telling anyone to go smoke pot. I'm not waving the cannabis flag high, but it's just not as toxic a drug or as dangerous a drug as alcohol.
So is the argument you're making here then fundamentally a moral one, a political one, an economic one, when I hear you saying legalize this?
I'm not saying legalize it, actually, and I think decriminalization is the best way to handle it.
That's something in between legalizing
it. The central question of the section on marijuana that I wrote is, how do we come to punish someone more harshly for a marijuana crime, a life sentence, than for killing somebody with a gun? The typical convicted killer in America serves 11 years in prison, and I, you know, found many cases of people getting life sentences without parole for marijuana crimes. So there's an enormous amount of unreason. There's all kinds of cultural prejudice and racial prejudice that is behind our marijuana laws. But to go from a country that can put you away for life for a joint, I mean, I write about a guy who had less than a joint who got a life sentence, to go from that to having marijuana perfectly legal and advertised on the Super Bowl along with Budweiser would be just one more instance of our swinging from one extreme to another.
But somewhere in the middle, you're saying we might have a more realistic road to walk down.
11 states have already decriminalized marijuana. The rate of marijuana use is no higher in those states. Portugal, Spain, Italy, the Netherlands have decriminalized marijuana. It's a way of taking the criminal justice system out of the issue of drug abuse and you know beginning to look at it from a public health point of view. Mm.
Andrew's calling from Boston. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I have so many things that your conversation has made me think about. I just want to say that I am an avid user of pornography, and I'm not ashamed to admit it.
Okay.
I think as far as the black market is concerned or the gray market is concerned, I think that the cash that comes into people's pockets through these kinds of activities is really important to them. I sell used items on Amazon, and my understanding is that this money is not taxable as long as it's like sort of more like a hobby than a main source of income.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it makes a difference in my life twice a month.
You're talking an economic difference, a financial difference.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it saves me. You know, it's a very unstable economy, and, you're in and out of work so quickly.
Andrew, let me ask you about on the pornography front. You say you're a frequent and enthusiastic consumer of pornography, but
yeah.
is your consumption in the above-ground market or the underground market? How would you describe it?
Oh, you don't need to go underground. American porn culture is here to stay. I mean, it's mainstream. It's as American as apple pie. You don't have to look far to find it. It's right in front of you everywhere you go.
Eric Schlosser, so is Andrew part of the underground economy you describe, or just another American buying girly magazines or whatever magazines?
Well, when he's purchasing porn through a legitimate distributor, he's part of the mainstream economy. And again, porn is becoming mainstream in the same way gambling has. Gambling used to be totally a black market activity. Now it's a major corporate activity, and for some reason, people aren't being punished the same way. I'm concerned about the volume of his sales that are unreported to the government, and those cash sales, I don't know the tax law, but that might put him in the underground economy, and he should be careful about the tax implications of that.
But Andrew's saying, hey, I'm an American just pursuing my interest. I'm not hurting anybody. I guess that's what he's saying. Let the porno flow to me.
Well, the porno part of it is it's a free country, and I think people should be able to buy that sort of stuff if they want to. But in terms of dealing in the cash economy, there's been a huge increase in that part of the underground as economic conditions have gotten worse. And it was the same thing in the old Soviet bloc, that people needed to work off the books in order to supplement their income. I'm certainly not going to condemn him personally for doing it by any means. But he should be careful.
And Randall Kennedy, we hear there in his reference to the Internet, there's an awful lot of commerce that goes on today at eBay, maybe through Amazon in Andrew's case, that doesn't fall under a tax man's hand.
Yeah, thus far. I'm sure that that's going to change. I mean, every government, of course, is always looking for new revenue streams, and I'm sure that this source of wealth will soon feel the pressure from the tax man.
We're talking tonight about black market America, the pot, porn, and illegal labor economy, the implications of the off-the-books economy, with author Eric Schlosser, author of the new book, Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. You can join the conversation. Is America regulated too much or too little? Are we over-regulated or too libertine? And when you eat your strawberries, do you care that you're eating illegal Mexican labor? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about black market America, the pot, porn, and illegal labor economy with muckraking author Eric Schlosser. He wrote Fast Food Nation a couple of years ago. Now he's out with Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. You can join the conversation as well. What most fuels the U.S. black market? American Puritanism, American hypocrisy, American law. And why do we look past the black market? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Gene's calling from Salem, Massachusetts. Hi, Gene. You're on the air.
Hi. Are there countries that do a good job at minimizing the black market? And if so, what are the percentages and how do they do it?
So let's see how the United States stacks up against the performance of others. It's a good question. Thanks, Gene. Eric Schlosser.
There are different aspects of the black market. There are other countries that have smaller drug criminal black markets in Western Europe. One extreme example would be Sweden, and they have not decriminalized drugs. They have not decriminalized marijuana, but they have a totally different approach. They have this public health service and health insurance, so that if you have a drug problem, boy, they put you into drug treatment immediately. And if you're even caught with a small amount of drugs, you know, you're sent into drug treatment. So they have very strict drug laws, but it's through their medical and public health system, not through their criminal justice system.
And therefore a smaller black market
A smaller black market around drugs, very little drug use in Sweden. On the other hand, some of these Scandinavian countries and these European countries have higher black markets in terms of, you know, working off the books, working in cash. It's the argument of this IMF economist that as taxes become higher, more and more people do that kind of, you know, day work off the books. Not necessarily illegal immigrants, but, you know, coming and painting your house in cash so that you can avoid
taxes. I've seen a lot of that in Europe. I mean, if you're using this black market economy as a yardstick of national hypocrisy or failure to step up to reality, do you think the United States is showing a bigger gap here than other countries? Or are we kind of in the mainstream? How would you judge? Have you judged?
I would think that in the most important aspects in the West, we're pretty extreme in our hypocrisy and in our contradictions. In Europe, especially in Germany, which has a large black market, they've had 9-10% unemployment for many, many years now. So in countries like that that have real economic hard times, yeah, there are going to be people working off the books. But there's nobody that has the same kind of moralistic attitudes that we have that are punishing people for their private behavior.
Jim's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I saw Eric's article in the Newsweek, and I would just like to make a quick comment, and that is in The Economist about 1997 or 98, there was a cover article on pornography and the Internet indicating that the demand for streaming audio and video was driving the state of the art in network computing. That was back in 97. Mm-hmm. I would say that the logical conclusion is that the current internet computing and technological telecommunications is driven by that the pornography industry, as indicated by this author.
Okay. Yeah, it's an interesting observation, Jim. How about it, Eric Schlosser? I've heard the case made that pornography essentially built the Internet, that it was the first big, viable industry out there, all kinds of technical innovations. What do you think?
Well, pornography has been at the forefront of many new technologies. The VCR, for example. The introduction of the VCR was really promoted by pornography. The mainstream Hollywood students wouldn't put their product on video cassette. The porn industry did, and a lot of people bought VCRs as a result. The same was true with CD-ROMs and DVDs and then the Internet. Clearly, this is a product that people want, and they're willing to get it through the latest technological means.
Randall Kennedy, is this the open frontier you were looking for on the legal front? Because the web wasn't fenced, things happened.
Well, on this question of technology, I find it hard to believe that the pornography industry built the technology or advanced it. It's that they exploited it. I mean, it's that people who they were looking for a buck, and people who are looking for a buck have often been the ones to, you know, see where new bucks can be gotten.
Well, I don't know. Maybe there's a bit of both here. I mean, they didn't lay down DARPA. They didn't challenge Al Gore or, you know, the Defense Department in putting down the initial research. On the other hand, the small kind of innovations like pop-up ads, I think the pornography industry was a big early innovator on that front on the web. Do you give this underground industry any credit on the technical front, Eric?
Well, I mean, again, I don't think that they have a series of software designers who are more brilliant than any other, but I think that, you know, they're less hidebound by big corporate structures, and as a result, they're probably elements that are more risk-taking and willing, you know, to be the first one to make a buck off of a new technology and not have to wade through years of committee discussion to do it.
They're very entrepreneurial.
Yeah.
And in that sense, very American.
Yeah, absolutely American.
Though, of course, there are realms of the pornography world that anybody would look at and say, my gosh, that looks destructive, that looks exploitative, that doesn't look like we want to build our economy or our technology on.
Yeah, well, there's no question that's true.
Joe's calling from Seneca, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to ask your guest a question. At what point, how does change happen? At one time, gambling was considered taboo in the United States.
Gambling, yeah.
And you know, our politicians could not even talk about that. And now, you know, it's almost mainstream America. I live just north of Illinois, and the Illinois governor is talking about enough casinos to pay for schools. So how would the people that want to legalize marijuana, I mean, what makes the government change?
That's an interesting question, Joe. Thanks for calling in with it. Eric Schlosser.
I mean, gambling was as black market as the marijuana industry just 25 or 30 years ago.
And we had prohibition for alcohol.
As recently as 1978, Nevada was the only state where there was legalized gambling. And now there are 28 states where there's legalized gambling. And in many ways, it is a disturbing trend to me, more disturbing than smoking marijuana. Gambling is essentially a form of tax on the poor.
Now, wait a minute. So is this you'd like to shove back under the covers, back into the underground economy?
No. I feel that adults should have the freedom to gamble their money or to drink or to smoke a joint. I'm not saying that the state should intervene, but at the same time, you can pass judgment on an activity. I think riding a motorcycle backwards without a helmet, you know, maybe is not such a great idea. What's interesting is how states, and your caller was absolutely right, states which used to prohibit gambling, crack down on gambling, are now promoting it officially through all these lotteries as a way of raising money for education, et cetera, et cetera.
But so what's the chemistry of change there? Joe's asking, what sets off that sequence of events that leads from, you know, absolute prohibition to national, practically, embrace?
Well, you know, I'm not an authority on the history of gambling, but you could probably see how it was profitable in Nevada. It became profitable for companies in Atlantic City. And then as Native Americans began to do it on the reservation, it just, the taboo against gambling gradually changed until now it's a corporate mainstream economic activity.
Randall Kinley, I'm sitting here thinking about your law school professor's view of all this and what I hear in your questions, the notion that this is an over-regulated society. If you look at kind of the greater good here, do you see that lid that's kept on as creating a pathology, an inequity, an injustice, or just an affront to liberty?
I see more misery being created by the misapplication of criminal law. If we're talking about pornography, if we're talking about marijuana. Now, I do think that we have to make a distinction between that and realms of our society that are underregulated. So when we talk about the terrible oppression, and that's the correct word, the oppression, I mean, of the these peons who are picking strawberries and other other agricultural goods, and their terrible plight, our society doesn't look after them. And so we do have a problem of under-regulation with respect to certain things and over-regulation with respect to others.
Bill's calling from Ocana Falls, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Yes, I want to ask, what's so a black market or underground economy when, in fact, in Wisconsin's dairy industry, the corporate dairy farms are subsidized with illegal labor? Not only that, but the county governments actually give courses, training programs to both the dairy farmers and their illegal owners in language phrases they should use. They present sessions on bank cards for transfers of money back to Mexico that don't require actual accounts, where, in fact, the laborers are given vaccinations. And it's contributing to the decline of the family farm. And yet, when you ask the sponsors of these, you know, do you check or do they have green cards? They say, that's not our business. If we're asked to respond to a farmer's need, we respond. They know exactly what's going on and it's not at all black market underground. It's very much a subsidy of dairy farms, corporate dairy farms.
Got it, Bill, and thanks so much for painting that picture. Eric Schlosser here. Bill's saying, hey, what's so underground about this? There's a very overt, and I'm taking from his tone, cynical use of illegal agricultural labor in Wisconsin and many other states. So underground or just off the legal landscape.
It's the spread of the black market. I mean, in the book, I write about how California agriculture pioneered the use of illegal immigrants. And that practice has slowly spread throughout the United States. In Fast Food Nation, I wrote about how meatpacking, which was one of the highest paid industrial jobs in the United States, quickly became one of the lowest paid through the recruitment of illegal immigrants. You didn't have illegal Mexican immigrants in Wisconsin 25 years ago, nor did you have them in the meatpacking plants of the Midwest. You mainly had these illegal immigrants in agriculture in California and the Southwest. This is a labor practice that is spreading throughout this economy, and it has huge implications for workers, as this gentleman was saying, for family farmers. And that's not to scapegoat these illegal immigrants at all, because they're very hardworking, decent people. But the people who are benefiting are corporations and, as he mentioned, corporate agriculture. Well, one of the things I try to point out in the book, again, is the myth of the free market. The government is very willing to intervene in the market in certain cases, i.e., punish you for having marijuana, but in other cases is willing to step back and allow these companies to exploit very poor people.
You know, with Bill's call, with your answer, I feel like I'm finally getting it a little more. The way things go out of plumb, out of square, out of perpendicular if there's too much black market around, because it doesn't have to be fair or right. It can just exist. It's outside the legal framework. You're painting a picture here where this element of the economy kind of, pulls things away from honesty. Honesty with ourselves, honesty with the people we deal with. I want to get one more call. Lou's calling from Boston. Hi, Lou. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. Two topics. One is the $100 bill and the $50 bill. I've heard talk over the years, and nothing ever happens to it, how that helps fuel illicit black market economies and drugs and weapons worldwide. And the other topic is, you know, my ninth grade son, he has more access to marijuana in the schools than he does to alcohol. I think decriminalizing it would just encourage young children to get involved with these drugs. And there's smokable heroin now coming to the suburbs, and ecstasy, and the list is a mile long of designer drugs. And it's all the people selling this. They also sell everything else. It's like going to Walmart. You know, one person doesn't sell marijuana and the other one doesn't.
But it works, and they've got a kind of department store. Lou, we'll take your editorial comment there, but I want to go to your factual note on the $100 bill, Eric Schlosser. Is this the primary currency of the black market?
It's the primary currency of the black market in the United States and throughout the world. About three-quarters of all $100 bills are now circulating overseas. It has a high face value. It's a reliable, stable currency. And it's no accident that they just discovered $1 billion in $100 bills in Iraq, because this was a very, very good way to keep your money and be able to use it in the international black market.
The billion that Saddam moved. You say at the end of the book, the underground is a good measure of the progress and the health of nations. When much is wrong, much needs to be hidden. In a nutshell, what does your book say is wrong?
The government is interfering in the personal lives of Americans and on moral grounds, and ignoring the greater immorality, which is economic exploitation.
Eric Schlosser, muckraker extraordinaire right now. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Eric Schlosser is author of the new book, Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. Randall Kennedy, sit back with us here for a second. What do you make of this picture?
What I make of it is that you can fasten on some unglamorous parts of our society, unglamorous industries, and look at those industries and see a lot of America. So here we look at the pornography industry. Here we look at the strawberry picking industry.
Fruit of the devil, Eric Schlosser writes, because you have to bend over to pick it every minute.
Right. Or you can look at other small, prosaic, banal things and see really the health of our society or the unhealthiness of our society in these little marginal, well, they're not marginal, they're important, but they're things that are very much with us. any event, thank you very much, Mr. Schlosser, for another eye-opening book.
Yes, indeed. Randall Kennedy, thanks for being with us tonight. Randall Kennedy is professor of law at Harvard University. You can continue this conversation online. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support for this.